you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have David Martin on the show. Of course, he is the author of The Assassination of James Forrestal and the co-author of The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton. David, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Thank you for coming on the show.
For my age, anyway.
James Forrestal, of course, James Forrestal had been Roosevelt's Secretary of the Navy. From April 1944, he became the first Secretary of Defense when the Armed Forces was consolidated under the National Security Act of 1947. He opposed the United Nations vote to partition Palestine and protested vigorously against U.S. recognition of Israel on the ground that U.S. interest in the Middle East would be seriously jeopardized by American sponsorship of a Jewish state. For his recalcitrance regarding Palestine, Forrestal became the target of much slander and calumny. Truman replaced Forrestal on March 28, 1949, shortly after his re-election. According to the received story, Forrestal, who was reportedly psychologically exhausted, fell into depression immediately. On April 2, 1949, he was interned against his will in Bethesda Naval Hospital. On the early morning of May 22, 1949, he fell to his death from the 16th floor, landing on the roof of the third floor. National authorities and the mainstream media immediately labeled his death a suicide without a criminal investigation. A review board was appointed on May 23rd, headed by Admiral Morton Wilcutts, to conduct hearings of members of the hospital staff, and it eventually put forth a conclusion that exonerated everyone in Forrestal's assumed suicide. Now, in your book, The Assassination of James Forrestal, you make a compelling case that Forrestal was actually murdered, and that his murder was ordered by the Zionists, most probably with the knowledge of the Truman administration. Correct? Is that a fair characterization of your thesis of your book?
That's pretty much accurate, except you said that Morton Wilcutts headed up the review board. He appointed the review board.
Okay.
He was the head of the National Naval Medical Center, of which Bethesda Naval Hospital is the main part. And so I call it the Wilcutts Report, sort of like the Warren Report, except that Warren was part of the board that produced the Warren Report. But Wilcutts was the person who appointed the board that reviewed it. You also said that there was no investigation, no police investigation, and that we don't know of any police investigation report, but from the testimony to the review board, one gets the impression, particularly from the testimony of the Navy photographers that they were doing, they were part of a police investigation. That would be the Navy police. But you know, that's gone into the drawer somewhere, if there was such an investigation. Because the first the guy who photographed the body and the one who photographed the room said that they were photographing looking for fingerprints, and we got some, he said, and nobody. There was no follow-up question like, well, whose fingerprints were there? You know? The review board was made up with one exception, I think, but he was not a police investigator, but they were Navy doctors, captains, who, you know, they weren't qualified to do a death investigation. You know, they were there to CYA, I think, and that's what they did. Because they finally produced that conclusion that nobody in the Navy was responsible for Forrestal going out the window. But they didn't even reach any conclusion as to what caused him to go out the window of the sixth, across the hall from the room in which he was kept. Was he pushed? Did he go out voluntarily? They only concluded that the fall caused his death. And in the official conclusion, there was no mention of what was apparently a bathroom sash, bathrobe sash, tied rather tightly around his neck. Although the newspapers said that he had apparently, and the biographers also who've written about it, said that he was apparently attempting to hang himself from the radiator below the window, as though jumping out a 16th floor window would not be sufficient to kill yourself if you were bent on committing suicide. So, I mean, that's the situation that passed for a valid explanation from the mainstream media of that time, which we have come to be a lot more suspicious of these days than people were back then.
Now, James Forrestal, first Secretary of Defense, this is the very early days of the Cold War, right after the Second World War. What were the intrigues or what were the issues of the day that led people or leads you to believe that he was a victim, you know, of Zionist intrigue, Zionist assassination squad? But what was going on at the time within the Truman administration?
Well, actually, Forrestal was really just the most courageous of the people within the foreign policy establishment, I would say, the most determined. There was virtual unanimity that it was not in the U.S. interest for Palestine to become a Jewish state. I mean, it's historically, you know, it's Muslim Arab, and it's only since the World War I and the Balfour Declaration gave the British mandate over Palestine. Well, the Balfour Declaration was a wartime measure to obtain Jewish support for the Allied war effort. The British were able to get the United States to come in on their side, I think, because of the Balfour. That was their promise, you know. You promised Palestine to us, and we'll pull the strings where we have a lot of power, in the United States to get them to come in on your side, and they did. And they got the League of Nations to give them, the British, the mandate for Palestine, which had been part of the Ottoman Empire. We know from, if anybody remember, Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence was able to mobilize the Arabs in the area, not just in Palestine, but throughout that region, to promise the Arabs if they would ally themselves against the Ottomans, you know, then they would get independence after World War One. But instead, they in Palestine, they were betrayed by the British, and they set up this. They got control, governmental control of Palestine, and let immigrants come from Europe year by year until eventually there were enough of them that they, in the late 30s, they actually proposed to partition Palestine, which is what they ended up, that's what happened in 1948. They actually, this is what the United Nations agreed to do, and that's what the whole U.S. foreign policy establishment was opposed to, knowing the history of the region and recognizing the long-term problems that this would create for us, which they have created. General George C. Marshall was the Secretary of State at the time, and he told President Truman that if they recognized this, you know, if they partitioned Palestine, he wouldn't vote for him in 48. I mean, he was very much opposed to him, but he was a military man, and so, you know, when it push came to shove, he saluted and said yes, sir, and went along with it. Forrestal was the greatest backbone, the most guts, the most balls, if you will, and he really spoke up, and I think it was a great fear that he was going to, even after he had been removed from office, that he was going to continue to tell the truth about where U.S. interests lay, and he was perceived as a major threat to the Zionist ambitions. Now, he was also the leading anti-communist in the Roosevelt and Truman administrations, and there was a book written in 1966. Published by the John Birch Society by a pseudonym in the name of Cornell Simpson, which it's called The Death of James Forrestal. And it makes a pretty strong case that Forrestal was assassinated, but it blames it on the communists. And indeed, the communists did have a record of assassinations, and where you compare it to Jan Masaryk, the leading anti-communist in the Czechoslovakian government, who went out of a window. They called it the defenestration of Prague. And the Soviets and the local authorities called it a suicide, which is very, very doubtful. And it's quite comparable to what happened to Forrestal, except Forrestal went out of a much higher floor window, the 16th floor. It didn't take such a long fall for Masaryk. So that's a sort of quick summary.
Yeah, excellent. Now, the understand, at least a lot of people understand, at least the way the media reported at the time, was that Forrestal had a nervous breakdown and was mentally ill. And in your book, you claim this isn't true. He was obviously under stress and may have been exhausted, but he had also gone on, he had been the target of a lot of criticism and sort of bashing in the media by the major media figures like Drew Pearson and Walter Winchell. You tell an interesting story about them.
A smear campaign led by the two most popular journalists of the day. I can recall as a youth, before we had television, listening to them on Sunday night. Our father was a liberal North Carolinian Democrat who listened to Drew Pearson every Sunday night, and we'd listen along with him. And when we could stand it, we'd listen to Walter Winchell. Walter Winchell was the conservative, Drew Pearson was the liberal, that we were supposed to like, but Drew Pearson leaned very heavily to the left, to the point of being almost pro-communist. And Walter Winchell was a very strong anti-communist. But they both agreed that Forrestal was just the worst reprobate imaginable. And after he took the position that he did on Palestine, and just the agreement of those two leading journalists is reason enough to think that it's his anti-Zionism that was his big problem in the eyes of the real powers that be in this country, as opposed to his anti-communism.
Yeah, that's very interesting that what connected the two, although one was left, one was right, they both agreed on the issue of Zionism and the Palestine question. And, of course, James Forrestal opposed that. And he, at the time... You claim that because there's a smear campaign,
yeah.
But of course 20 years later,
and really the leading biographers agree on that.
Yeah,
even Arnold Rogo, the very pro-Zionist biographer, who made up a lot of things as I found out, but a more balanced biographer and sort of the definitive biography is Driven Patriot, The Life and Times of James Forrestal by Townsend Hoops and Douglas Brinkley. Hoops is dead now. Hoops, by the way, was a Yale skull and bones man. and a high Department of the Air Force official. And pretty much a blue blood type. Douglas Brinkley is a young historian on the make, and we've seen he's made out very well.
Yeah, he's an establishment historian who does a lot of TV appearances. Yeah,
just about the best known historian in the country these days.
But here, in your book, you talk about how The Zionist interest in the United States and throughout the West, really, but particularly the United States, they relied on a campaign not only of slander, but also blackmail and perhaps even murder. There's a history of Jewish terrorism, of course, people who are opposing their agenda being assassinated. But even critics of Forrestal agree that he was wiretapped and he was being bugged, yet they call him paranoid. Which is kind of strange, right?
I think that's in the Aaron's and
The Secret War Against the Jews.
Yeah, The Secret War Against the Jews. Yeah, they pretty much concede that his phone calls were being monitored and that they. An attempt was made to blackmail him, and they write, I mean, rather proudly that they successfully blackmailed Nelson Rockefeller because Rockefeller's wartime or 1930s dealings with the Nazis, and they held that over Rockefeller's head, and Rockefeller had a lot of influence with governments in Latin America where they had a lot of the business dealings, And they were able to get Rockefeller, according to these authors, to prevail upon the governments of Latin America to vote for the partition in the United Nations. I mean, our government did a great deal of arm twisting in the United Nations to get a majority in the General Assembly to vote for the partition of Palestine.
And there
but
is,
but it didn't work. And the, anyway, Forrestal had been the president of Dillon Reed, the investment banking firm in Wall Street, and they had had dealings with the Nazis. There's lots of American businesses had, but Dillon Reed was owned by a Jewish man, Clarence Dillon, whose birth name was Lapowski. Son of a department store or a clothing merchant in San Antonio, Texas. And anyway, he was Jewish. And probably that's one of the things that made it difficult to blackmail the president of Dillon Reed over dealing with the Nazis during the 30s, as lots of people did. And anyway, the Forrestal ignored their blackmail attempts.
But wasn't he visited by one Bernard Baruch, too, and I guess given a veiled threat not to oppose?
Well, you can take it as a veiled threat. This is in the Forrestal Diaries. He reported on a luncheon meeting he had with Baruch, who told him that it was not in his own best interest to continue to try to work behind the scenes and publicly too to oppose this American partition plan. It mattered. I don't know. Forrestal just brushed it off and didn't take it as a threat. But it may well have been a threat when he said it wasn't in his own best interest. And there's a question, you know, I kind of wonder if Forrestal might have known about the 1947 letter bombs that were sent to the White House by members of the Stern Gang, the terrorist, the Jewish terrorist outfit.
Mm-hmm.
This is not very well known. And I speculate in the book about how many people really knew about it, you know, because it wasn't reported in the newspapers. And it only came out, I think, in 1949 in the memoirs of the guy that ran the mailroom of the White House. But that didn't get any publicity. And it only got some mild publicity when Margaret Truman, the daughter of Harry Truman, wrote in her biography of her father about this attempt on her father's life. I've looked at all the Truman biographies I can find, and hers is the only one that even mentions that.
Shocking.
That's incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And I discovered it reading, I forget what book, I was on Amazon, and I was reading a customer's review of this book, and this customer made mention of it. And I said, what is this? I never heard of this. So I began looking into it, and then I go to the website, several websites. There's a website on letter bombs. There's no mention of these letter bombs. It's there now. There's a website on Harry Truman's website that was mentioned. Well, I think that's assassination attempts on Harry Truman. Well, all at that time, all I found was that of the Puerto Rican nationalists who had attempted to shoot him at the Blair House when they were doing renovation in the White House, and he was living across Pennsylvania Avenue in the Blair House. And that was the only mention of it. But now there is just brief mention, a little bit. It's gone up and down on Wikipedia, how much it's mentioned. You can trace the history of it. There's still, I mean, how many people know that? But you would think that Forrestal would have known it at the time that this had happened, and would have been pretty wary about the dangers that he was under if they would attempt to assassinate the president. Of course, they had assassinated the chief UN negotiator on Palestine, Count Folke Bernadotte from Sweden, who'd been a big benefactor of the Jews during World War II. But he was pursuing too even-handed a policy, apparently. And of course, that people like David Ben-Gurion and the Zionist leaders who disavow what the Jewish terrorists were doing, but of course later those Jewish terrorists, like Menachem Begin, became prime minister. You know, I mean, they're regarded as heroes by the current government of Israel. So
there were also attempts. Weren't there also attempts made on like Ernest Bevin and two and.
Shimon Peres was another one of the those terrorist leaders who became prime minister.
But this history of Zionists resorting to bribes, bullets, and bombs is largely written out of the history books. I mean, a lot of people know about the King David bombing.
The King David Hotel. You know, that did kill quite a few people and a lot of innocent people. The famous Levant affair. Now there was the false flag attempts that they were just caught red-handed. The plan to actually there were some bombings of that didn't kill anybody. The U.S. facilities in Egypt, and they caught some of the perpetrators who were Jews from Israel, or maybe I think some of them were Egyptian Jews who were doing the bombing, and it was blamed on the Egyptian Muslims, and then they were caught in the act. Of course, those people were regarded as heroes in Israel today. But a pure false flag attack, and of course the ultimate failed false flag attack was the attack on the USS Liberty. And the more we've learned, the more it has become obvious that ship was attacked during the Six-Day War with the intention of sinking it, and everybody being killed, and it was to be blamed on the Egyptians, and the cry was to go up, remember the Liberty, and we were to go in with both feet on the side of the Israelis against the Egyptians. In fact, we had actually sent planes, put them in the air, that were armed with nuclear weapons. And this is all very well documented in Phil Nelson's book, Remember the Liberty, which I've reviewed on my website, dcdave.com.
That's interesting, because the Liberty, the cover-up of the Liberty occurred during the Lyndon Baines Johnson administration, and Lyndon Johnson actually shows up in James Forrestal's hospital room, right?
Well, according to either Hoops or Brinkley interviewed Marx Leva, the assistant. That's their source for that information. Mm-hmm. His name does not appear in the nurse's notes or the visitors to Forrestal's room, but we know of some other people who visited Forrestal's room that who don't appear in those nurse's notes. In fact, there's a gap of a few days in the nurse's notes where it might have been during one of those days. But according to Levin, I don't see Levin have any reason to make it up. Levin said that that Johnson visited Forrestal very much against Forrestal's will, which stands to reason because even then he was just newly elected and in a vote. Dubious vote count election, by the way. Mm-hmm. That's why they called him Landslide Lyndon. It was an ironic title for him, Landslide Lyndon. And he was already very much a Zionist partisan. So, and a person of much, much lesser stature than Forrestal at the time. And there's just no reason why Forrestal would have wanted to give the guy the time of day, much less have come to visit him in the hospital room. The telling thing is the people who could have visited Forrestal and didn't, like his top aide, Marx Leva, never came to see him. Like Robert Lovett, the person whose estate that he was flown to down at Hobe Sound, Florida, who later became Secretary of Defense himself, I think, or Secretary of State. But anyway, he was the Under Secretary of State at the time. And Lovett never came to visit. Nobody, none of these people who were close, supposedly close to him, came to visit him in the 7 weeks or so that he was in the Bethesda Naval Hospital. His wife visited him many times, but his brother Henry was forbidden to visit him by the hospital authorities until he threatened to go public with their forbidding him to see him. And so he did get to see him, and when he got to see him, he reported that he seemed to be as normal as anybody he'd ever seen. He didn't seem to be the least bit, you know, depressed or out of his mind in any way. Perfectly normal.
At the time of his death, of course, he's out of government. He's been removed as Secretary of Defense. It looks like he's been removed from power. So why would the Zionist or anyone have to kill him if he's out of power?
Well, his first love was journalism, and he had already tried to buy either Time or Newsweek, or he wanted to perhaps even start his own news magazine, and he was going to write his memoirs. He was a strong-willed person, and he had very strong opinions. And he had a lot of money, and he had a lot of contacts in the higher reaches of finance and the government. And he had a great deal of stature in the country still, in spite of the smear campaign that had been waged against him by these powerful people in the press. So he would have been a continuing threat, because as we know, public opinion is the most important thing. In fact, I've found a great quote from the first Lincoln-Douglas debate, where Abraham Lincoln said, "In this and like societies, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, everything is possible. Without public sentiment, nothing is possible. You know, therefore, those who mold public sentiment go deeper than those who make laws or issue judgments." He's saying, really, that the power of the press is more powerful than that of the legislative or the judicial branches of the government. And so that was why he was a major threat. And in my estimation, that's what I say in the book.
Now, this is his death is what 1949, and if you look at the establishment of Israel, it was aided, and I think the Jewish criminal network, the gangsters, played a big part, including Murder Incorporated, evidently, mm-hmm. in getting the Zionist state established. Assassination. Well, it's always been a part of policy, you know, Machiavellian realpolitik. But what we're seeing here is that at this crucial moment in time, in a supposedly free republic where we're supposed to be able to debate these issues, our representatives of a free press, but debates being shut down first by, by slander, and then by murder, by assassination. And this, they have at their resources people who can do this because they have Murder Incorporated. It's interesting because this is 15 years before the Kennedy assassination, and both men seem to have met their demise challenging Zionist interests. And of course, with James Forrestal, it was the establishment of Israel, and then with JFK, some have theorized that. Least his assassination, one faction involved in that was the Zionist or Israeli faction for Kennedy's efforts in preventing Israel from getting the atomic bomb. Do you find those connections interesting at all?
Yeah, and also I think that the Six-Day War was in the works, and even that. That false flag attack on the USS Liberty mm-hmm. may have been in the planning works. This before the JFK assassination. It was all, and you can't imagine JFK countenancing, going along with this sort of the way. Lyndon was their boy, you know. Mm-hmm. Lyndon did everything that they wanted. So now there is a possibility that that they finagled even for JFK to defeat Nixon with LBJ as his vice president with the assassination already planned. Mm-hmm. You know, that this is how they would get Lyndon in. You know, first we'll, in fact, that. There was the mob was involved in Chicago, you know, and manipulating some votes in Illinois, which could have swung the election for JFK. But it could be that the Zionists weren't thinking, "Oh, we'll get JFK elected," but rather we'll get LBJ in through assassination. And I mean, this all could have been planned that way. There are a couple of good books on it. Michael Collins Piper's
yes.
Final Judgment.
Yeah.
And a much lesser known book by an erstwhile friend of mine who uses a pseudonym that I gave him, by the way, called Salvador Astucia. Astucia means astuteness in Spanish. Actually, he chose the first name, Salvador, which means savior in Spanish. So astute savior, I guess, would be Salvador mm-hmm. Astucia. And his book is Opium Wars. And it's he independently came up with the conclusion that it was the Zionists. I know it was independently because I had read Michael Collins Piper's book, and as he's laying out his thesis to me, that he got from reading On the Trail of the Assassins by by Jim Garrison. Clay Shaw was the head of the, he was the guy that Garrison went after as connected to the assassination there in New Orleans. And that Trade Center was a Zionist front in New Orleans.
That's right. Yeah. The trademark. Yeah. He was connected to that bank in Switzerland, right?
Yeah.
Rosenbaum was his name?
Herman Dex, I think, is the mother outfit.
Yeah. And that was owned by Rosenbaum, right? Or the
Anyway, connected to them was a guy by the name of Louis Bloomfield, who was a lawyer for the arch-Zionists from Montreal, Edgar Bronfman.
Well, he's connected to Lansky and everything. Sigrum's, yeah.
Sigrum's fortune.
Mm-hmm.
So that was where Astutia made the connection. Through Clay Shaw and Perman Dax and Louis Bloomfield and Edgar Bronfman, and there you have it. You know, I helped him go a little bit further with the appointment of Supreme Court Justice, who was a Supreme Court. Now my 76-year-old brain is failing me. he stepped down from the Supreme Court to replace Adlai Stevenson as a UN ambassador when Adlai Stevenson conveniently died of a heart attack. And, who was a Supreme Court justice, Jewish, and very strong Zionist, who had worked for OSS for I can't think of his name. But anyway, he was a UN ambassador during the Six-Day War. And had Adlai Stevenson not died and had this guy not stepped down from the Supreme Court, is this not a demotion? I mean, to leave the Supreme Court, become a United Nations ambassador? That's pretty suspicious, I should think. And anyway, that's all in Astutia's book. It's something else that sort of implicates the Zionists.
Goldberg?
Yeah. Yeah, Arthur Goldberg.
There you go.
Goldberg had worked for OSS and during World War II,
mm-hmm.
with dealings with Palestine. And so had Louis Bloomfield. All very interesting intrigue. That's all in Salvador Astutia's book. And mm-hmm. Salvador Astutia also maintains that Lyndon Johnson was actually a crypto Jew, which a lot of people have argued. His best argument is, look at Lady Bird. That's not a Jewish woman. He's never seen one. She certainly doesn't look Jewish.
Yeah, I heard his father actually gave money for the defense of the guy in Atlanta who killed Mary Fagan.
Huh?
You know, the trial, Leo Frank. Leo Frank.
Oh, yeah.
I had heard that he, because that's back when Lyndon was just a little boy, but that's interesting that he had given money, you know, that for the defense of Leo Frank. I don't know if that's true or not. But it is interesting. I mean, you have at first, and you mentioned that the John Birch Society with that book trying to blame the communists on the murder of James Forrestal, sort of misdirecting the conspiracy theories.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. I mean, that came out sort of in the wake of the Rogo book. The mm-hmm. Rogo book came out in 1963. I think the Cornell Simpson pseudonym book came out in 66, but it claimed that actually, the manuscript had been written very shortly after that it happened, in like in 1950, and then weren't able to find a publisher, he said, and it just went into the drawer. And then when he actually published in 66, he wanted to keep the flavor of the time, and he didn't update anything. Well, and that gives him the excuse to ignore all of the misrepresentations that are in the Rogow book. You know, Rogow, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, R-O-G-O-W, Arnold Rogow. So there's no mention of Rogow's book at all, you know, given the excuse that, you know, that he's just reproducing this earlier manuscript. But Medford Evans, also writing for the John Birch Society publication, has a glowing review of the book, of Cornell Simpson's book. And he doesn't have the excuse of ignoring Rogow's book. It's a quite long review in the John Birch Society magazine, the time, his name I forget. But he doesn't make any mention of the Rogow book either in his review. And there's really no excuse for that. He doesn't have the same excuse that Cornell Simpson does. We've got a whole chapter on, you know, what the John Birch Society. I've had correspondents who work in the John Birch Society who concluded that really they were nothing but a Zionist front, you know, playing sort of as is laid out in the protocols of the learned elders of Zionists, playing all sides.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, covering the conservative base, covering the liberal base, and creating their own opposition. I think that's what we see going on with Cornell Simpson's book. As good as it is, there's a lot of really interesting information from an anti-communist perspective. A lot of it, the exposés in the Simpson book are also expanded upon and with much that scholars have learned since then are dead accurate about the infiltration of the government. A lot of the stuff I've written, the infiltration of the Roosevelt and Truman administrations by the communists. And we've got the younger Evans, M. Stanton Evans, who just died a couple of years ago, is blacklisted by a history book about Joe McCarthy's. It's really an outstanding book on McCarthy. Although, of all the people he talks about infiltrating the administration, he makes no mention whatsoever of one David Niles, who was a holdover in the Truman administration for the Roosevelt administration, who was both a Zionist and a communist, and probably the most powerful guy in the both White Houses, next to the president, if not more so. And for some reason, of all these infiltrators of the government, M. Stanton Evans manages not to mention David Niles. None of these other communists were notable Zionists like Niles was, so I think that may well be, in fact, is the most obvious reason why he's ignored by M. Stanton Evans. He's not ignored by Cornell Simpson. He mentions him quite a bit, but always as a communist, not as a Zionist.
And I guess it was David Niles who I think you're right, was having a homosexual affair with a communist spy during the war?
He threatened, I forget the name of it, he threatened to, what was he going to do, expose one of his homosexual lovers if he didn't leave his wife for him or something like that. He threatened to expose him. I mean, he was a piece of work, was David Niles. And he was, later, the Truman administration expelled him from the White House after he was caught passing classified information from the U.S. military to the Israelis.
Well, for the longest time, it was difficult to distinguish communists from Jews. So often you were talking about the same group and what role communism played. Of course, communism, Bolshevism itself, was largely a Jewish project. But that's a conversation for another day. But I do, with Joseph McCarthy, I think that that quote from Forrestal where he goes, he's telling the young senator, I guess he's talking about what's happening with the government and the communist infiltration of the U.S. government in the immediate post-war era. And I think he told Joe McCarthy, consistency never has been a mark of stupidity. If the diplomats who have mishandled our relations with Russia were merely stupid, they would occasionally make a mistake in our favor.
Yeah.
But I think what happened was during the Cold War, you could identify communist infiltration. It was real, but that was only one level. At the meta level, there is a higher level infiltration of the U.S. government, which communism, I think, in the final analysis was just a tool, a phase, perhaps, the Cold War. And one thing I think I wrote reading your book is, why is it that when you if you become skeptical or you analyze the infiltration or the manipulation or the influence or of Jewish interests, Zionist interests, Jewish organizations of the U.S. government, that is taboo. You can't do that. You're called an anti-Semite, and you lose all credibility, reputation. You're ostracized, and if that doesn't work, you're eventually thrown out a window, perhaps. But this is the one of the problems even today, where Forrestal was prescient in his opposition to the formation of the Jewish state, because although the United States never had to go directly militarily support Israel, recent history has shown that we have gone to war many times, and those wars are largely because of Jewish influence in the U.S. government, Israeli influence in U.S. government.
I don't think anything could be more obvious. Yeah. You know? Really, I mean, it's right down to this latest drone strike on the top general of Iran. I mean, mm-hmm. It's the most outrageous thing imaginable. In my estimation, I must hate to admit that I actually, as E. Michael Jones has said, with Hillary Clinton as a candidate, he would have voted for Vlad the Impaler
yeah.
against her. Well, I'm afraid I felt the same way,
Well, even E. Michael Jones said, yeah.
I voted for a major candidate.
E. Michael Jones says the foreign policy is controlled by three Jews, Bernard Marcus, Sheldon Adelson, and Paul Singer. And it's being done for, these Jewish oligarchs who are, obviously they're tied into Israel and the Zionists and all that. So it's even our confrontation, our tension between the United States and Iran is, I'm looking at a map. It's I can say it's only because of Israel. I can't think of any other reason why they'd be considered an enemy in any way.
Well, I don't know why Russia or Iran needs to be our enemy.
Yeah.
If we're just looking after the interest of the American people as Americans,
mm-hmm.
Russia's not a evangelical communists trying to spread their communist influence. And I mean, they're not trying to subvert our government anymore, in spite of all this Russiagate baloney,
Well, who's meddling in U.S. Who's really meddling in U.S. elections?
Yeah, I mean, they're more Christian country than the United States mm-hmm. is these days, I think. And so why are we treating Russia like an enemy these days? And all of this stuff in Ukraine is a joke. That we don't have any interest in Ukraine. They have lots of interest. The Donetsk and Luhansk are primarily Russian-speaking territories. There's a separatist movement there. And Crimea is historically Russian. And, you know, there was an overwhelming popular vote for Crimea to return to Russia. And there was no Russian invasion. They had a navy base there. It's their main entry in the Black Sea. It's a vital strategic interest to the Russians to keep that navy base and for those Russians people of Crimea to be part of Russia again. Didn't make much difference when Khrushchev gave them to Ukraine. It was all part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, at that time.
So the totally ahistorical discussion of what's going on in Ukraine these days.
Well, Victoria Nuland, I don't think she's Baptist.
We're getting pretty far off the forest, all the
time. Yeah, but I mean, obviously, what we're seeing today's foreign policy, and the hijacking of U.S. foreign policy for the benefit of Israel and Jewish interests, goes back to these assassinations. Because perhaps if they hadn't been successful, or the media had reported on the Forrestal assassination and Jewish involvement, Zionist involvement in that death, JFK might not have been assassinated. And they wouldn't have the takeover, show the Jewish or the Zionist or Jewish ascendancy in the 1970s, and so the takeover of U.S. foreign policy that we see today, which is causing so much trouble throughout the world. So this is why your book is so important, because it goes back to this historical event, which has been so misunderstood and misreported by the media and these things. And you make the point in the book where, hey, if the communists had done it, okay, they're not beyond doing that, but they didn't control the media at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly. That's the main thing that militates against the Cornell Simpson thesis. Mm-hmm. Is that had it been the communists behind it, they had a lot of influence in the government, but nobody's really argued that the communists by 1949 were controlling the United States media. Not even people like M. Stanton Evans would argue that, I don't think.
Yeah, Walter Winchell was working directly with the ADL, and so was J. Edgar Hoover, which is...
dissent. J. Edgar Hoover would have hardly covered up for the communists either.
No, he wouldn't have, but he would cover up for Murder Incorporated because he was apparently blackmailed as well, so...
I don't think you can argue that. And of course, the other big, huge red herring, you'll see it, is it was all about suppressing information about UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
and I think that's just a red herring. Even if there was something to the actual UFOs that Forrestal might have known something about, I don't think he would have had any particular incentive to go public with it.
Yeah, so it's either like red communist or little green men diverting us from the truth.
And with all the precedent we have of Zionist assassinations, I don't know of any precedent of assassinating people to keep a lid on the UFO story.
That's another thing. I mean, they write books. Jewish journalists write books about the Mossad and its assassination as a policy tool, and they're proud of it.
That's the thing. Check out Unz.com.
Yes,
today. You've got Ron Unz's review of "Rise Up and Strike First" by. What's his name? Ronan. The name's escaped me. But anyway, his review, I think, is longer than the book. It's 27,200 words.
Yeah, it's about four. I looked at it. I was going to read it. Then I saw how long it was. I couldn't have time to read it today. It's like 40 pages.
Well, you get down to about the 20,000th word, and he actually recapitulates some good things he said about My Forrestal research.
Yes.
In there.
So,
well, he didn't update it since he wrote that. I've come out with the book, and he didn't mention the book.
So,
but that's made up for by Narang, you know, in an accompanied article.
Yes.
It's all about the book. It's on Unch.com today.
Yes. So I said I'd have you for 45 minutes, so we're well past that, so I want to be respectful of your time.
Yeah, well, my jaw muscles are wearing out.
Yeah, so I'm let you. I want to thank you for coming on the show and sharing with us your information. Your book, again, is The Assassination of James Forrestal. Where's the best place to get that book?
I'm afraid Amazon's not the only place. You know, we've also published it for bookstores to buy, but we have wholesale. But it's not in too many bookstores. So Amazon's, okay. But Amazon has been discounting the price, and we're still getting the same royalty, even though they discount it. So I mean, it's a steal, and it's selling quite well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just wish I had the time and energy and good health to spend all my royalties. Yeah, it's doing very well. And I think after today, the publicity it's got on
Amazon,
it's going to do even better.
Yeah,
it's been very steady, really. It's the sales have not gone. You would think that, you know, you'd have the first big splash, and then there would be a little reduction. But they've been very steady, and I think November, we came out with it in March, and well, maybe it was May. I think that's right. We came out just a day after May 23rd. He went out of the window on May 22nd. The book official publication date was May 23rd. But November and December were our best sales months so far.
So, yeah, great. And that the appearance on Un's review is completely coincidental with our interview tonight. That was funny. We were recording on the 27th, so.
Yeah, we read the reviews on there, you know. People are giving it good reviews. So the word's getting around. And thanks to people like you, I certainly appreciate you're taking the time to do the interview.
Well, certainly welcome. And, of course, thank you for coming on the show. I'll let you go. Wish you a good night. That, again, is David Martin. And you can, I guess, follow your work at DC Dave.
Yeah, DCDave.com. You can look there. But the best place is just searching on Amazon.com.
So, okay, well, good night then. Thank you so much.
And talk of all the things we did today. Here and laugh about our funny little ways while we have a few minutes to breathe. And I know that it's time you must leave, but darling, be home soon. I couldn't dare to wait an extra minute if you dawdle. My darling, be home soon. It's not just these few hours, but I've been waiting since I toddled for the great relief of having you to talk to. And now a quarter of my life is almost past. I think I come to see myself at last. And I see that the time spent confused was the time that I spent without you. And I feel myself in blue. So darling, be home soon. I couldn't bear to wait an extra minute if you got home. My darling, be home soon. It's not just these few hours, but I've been waiting since I toddled for the great relief of having you to talk to. trouble. My darling, be home soon. It's not just these few hours, but I've been waiting since I toddled for the great relief of having you to talk to. Go and beat your crazy head against the sky. Try and see beyond the houses and your eyes. It's okay to shoot the moon. Darling, be home soon. I couldn't bear to wait an extra minute if you'd go. My darling, be home soon. It's not just these few hours, but I've been waiting since I toddled for the great relief of having you to talk.